speaking this morning about the, say, the gradual path, gradual training of the Buddhas, what came to mind is a whole other set of teachings around a gradual instruction, and that probably comes up more often in the suttas. The Pali is anupupikatha, sort of the verses, teachings that follow on from each other, so that when the Buddha would teach, give instruction, he would lay it out in a gradual way, because it, just the nature of the human mind, you know, you have to build on your understanding, or you have to build on your ability to actually comprehend something clearly and deeply. And it's helpful to have a set of stairs to get up to the top floor of a building or an elevator or something, rather than, you know, just get up there. Mm-hmm. You know, you're here, there's the top of that building, 30 feet away, just, what are you waiting for? Get up there. The reality is there has to be a structure or a network to be able to do that. Just because we can conceive of the top of the building doesn't necessarily mean we can get there. So the Buddha, in his graduated teaching, he would be say instruction, talk on generosity, on virtue, on heaven, on drawbacks, the bane of things, on renunciation, and then the Four Noble Truths. So I'd say I think it's a helpful structure to reflect on for our own practice, because, you know, oftentimes we don't want to mess with the rinky-dink stuff. We just want to get on, you know, just give me the straight scoop. And of course, everyone does, you get the straight scoop, and you sort of feel bewildered. What do we do? So that, the graduated teaching and a gradual approach is appropriate for the human condition, for us. And as we lay a foundation of different aspects of goodness, virtue, right view, right practice, then, and it isn't as if it's a linear thing, that you've got to get this bit down, the generosity bit down, then you can go on to the virtue. It's, you know, something that you're doing all the time, really kind of constantly filling in the gaps and layering your practice, so that they're kind of like an image that I kind of thought of was like a lock in a shipping lane, or where you've got a level of the river and your level of rapids, and then a ship or a boat goes in, and then the water comes in, and it lifts it up to the level of the water, and then it can go in. And sort of, it's kind of like that with our hearts, and being able to pay attention to a quality like generosity. It's not as if it's, generosity is a beginning aspect of traditional Buddhism. It's a quality of mind, of heart, a mindset that allows one to really just give of oneself. And when we do, if that's our perspective, then in practice, I mean, there's a certain delight and joy that comes from giving, from generosity, and then the generosity isn't isolated. So especially when generosity is connecting us with good people, then we have all sorts of opportunities for reflection and teachings or perspectives that we might not have considered. But then also that giving of oneself, and it isn't just the material giving that is important, but it's the attitude behind it that is really the heart leaps forward at being able to give and to be generous. And if you think in terms of meditation, when does your meditation become successful and when does it not become successful? And it's like when you're able to take an object of meditation, whatever it is, and just give yourself to it, then the mind really settles very quickly, as opposed to pick up the meditation object and, what am I going to get out of this? How much do I have to do in order to really to get that goal? There isn't a generosity of spirit there. So then, one ends up not very peaceful and kind of frustrated in one's meditation. So generosity is there is a, obviously there is an aspect with the with material giving, but it's also it's an avenue for cultivating the qualities of mind so that dana is not just something that one is doing through material things. It's through the quality of heart that is ready to give, to share, to help, to be a benefit, and that has a real positive effect on this gradual path and training, where we're able to really grow in the Dhamma, when we give ourselves to it. Virtue is very similar. I mean, when I talked a bit about that this morning, as it being a part of a gradual path, and virtue being a quality that as we establish ourselves in virtuous qualities, the effect in terms of relationship with other people is really bonds of trust are established, and that's a huge piece, not just for social well-being, a strength of a society or a culture. It really has to be established on bonds of trust. But internally, also within as we become more confident in, our own intention, and that's one of the things that Ajahn Chah used to point out that the one of the values of keeping precepts, paying attention to a moral training, as you start to understand volition, the movement of mind behind an action, the movement of mind behind speech, the movement of mind behind our mental states. So that as we, and that's the essence of, say, of kamma. And the Buddha is very explicit in this. Kamma is volition. It's not, yeah, there are actions, how it's displayed, but kamma and its results are based on that volition behind it. So that being able to understand volition, then we can start to understand kamma, how it affects us. And that's actually, say, one of the... there's many different ways that the Buddha expressed his enlightenment. And the most common way that we hear is like in Dhammacakka Sutta, where the Buddha is saying, it wasn't until I understood these Four Noble Truths and their 12 aspects that I was able to declare my full and unexcelled enlightenment, awakening. But also, there's suttas where the Buddha says, it wasn't until I was able to understand kamma and its results. Because kamma is just the verb to do, it's action. And then there's the result of that action, kamma vipaka. And of course, that's, we reap the fruits of that all the time. And sometimes we, you know, feel like kind of helpless bystanders. But in reality, we need to be, let's say, taking responsibility for the whole process. So that understanding kamma, understanding volition, that's where it isn't just because one studies it in a book or read a good essay on kamma that one is able to understand. It's because one really starts to investigate one's actions, one's speech, one's movement of mind, that one can start to see it more clearly, understand it more clearly, and it's through that understanding that we're able to take responsibility. So, knock-on benefit of virtue, keeping precepts. It's part of a gradual training. All of these, and you start seeing that all of these different practices that are the Buddha lays out at, say, at the beginning of the path, have huge effects for the conditioning, the result of the path, the fruition of the path, so that. Again, it's not a linear, gradual path. It's an integrated path of training and understanding, and being able to, say, instruct ourselves, learning how to teach ourselves, learning how to train ourselves, and taking on is that okay? Generosity, virtue, heaven, the drawbacks. Renunciation, Four Noble Truths, and picking that up and reviewing, reflecting, practicing with it, teaching ourselves. In that discourse that I mentioned this morning of the Buddha's teaching to an accountant, and about a gradual path, toward the end of the discourse, the accountant asks, "Well, there is this teaching that you have, and it's for the realization of Nibbana. Does everybody realize Nibbana?" The Buddha says, "Well, some do and some don't." And they persons are. Well, why is that? Because the Nibbana is there, the teaching is there. And then the Buddha says, well, let me put it this way. They were in Savatthi at the time, and of course the accountant is a minister in service of the king, and so the adjacent large kingdom was, capital was in Rajagaha, so quite a distance. But so the Buddha asked him, do you know the way to Rajagaha? He said, oh yeah, certainly, I've been many times. And he says, well, if somebody asked you to go, could you explain it to them? He says, oh yeah, certainly. And do you think everybody would get there? Said, oh no. some would make there and some would lose their way. And why is that? He gave clear instructions. So it's exactly the same way with Nibbana. The goal is there, the teachings are there, and we have to learn how to put those teachings into practice and not lose our way. Learn how to put that gradual path into practice, into our life. The next aspect of this graduated teaching that the Buddha gives is Sangha, heaven, or heavenly states is maybe might be a bit more accessible to most Westerners, but that recognition that there's actually more to our experience than just sort of mundane, ho-hum, kind of dreary life, getting on with the practical aspects of it, with a bit of respite now and again. But there actually are, the human heart is actually capable of heavenly states, and if one extrapolates from that, well, there's probably realms where those are manifested. But it's not, how do you say, it's not a essential piece of dogma that one needs, but to recognize, yeah, there are qualities of mind that are refined, are beautiful, and they're possible when the mind experience, and that's where the divine abidings. Loving kindness, compassion, sympathetic joy, equanimity. These are called divine abidings. As when we dwell in, say, loving kindness, and our wish is for our own and all other beings' happiness and well-being, we view the world in a radically different way. When we view through the world and ourselves through the lens of compassion, really attuned to that wish to alleviate suffering in the human condition and our own condition, we view and experience the world in a very different way. And it isn't as if one doesn't recognize or see the flaws, see the difficulties, but it's a way to direct attention that is deeply gratifying. To be able to respond to the world with bright states of mind. One of the monks in our tradition has been translating the divine abidings, the Brahma Viharas, as mature emotions. That's a really pretty skillful way of putting it. And when we're sort of the emotions of irritation, fear, gratification, those are, you know, not so mature. You can see that in just about any infant. And so that, but as practitioners, we have access to teachings and practices that allow us to lift up the heart to something that is, yeah, that is heavenly, that is divine. It's possible. It's not that it's not possible. It's that we don't choose to direct our attention in that way. I mean, there is that the feeling of being a helpless victim of the either internal moods or external things around us. But it's important to realize, as a gradual and graduated instruction, that which is heavenly is a part of our human experience, and we can choose to cultivate that. They say the next step in that graduated instruction is on the drawbacks, adinava. I mean, there is the heavenly, there is the divine, and there's definitely the drawbacks. There's the painful side of experience, and we have to recognize that, just painful and difficult side of having a human body. You know, one can sort of see advertisements for sort of some health product of some sort where everybody is just vibrant and young, and but that ain't what I'm experiencing. there's drawbacks to it's like I just changed where we're going for the doctor. There's a new clinic in Ukiah, so I have to get registered there, and there. So then they start asking, you know, what's your history, and what have you had, you know, ever had any surgery? And yeah, it took a while. and I didn't even get into the different illnesses. it's just the drawback of having a human body. They're subject to aging, subject to sickness, subject to death. And it's not that it's all doom and gloom. It's just sort of, it's part of the picture. In order to be able to really awaken. It's really important to see the whole picture. There is that possibility of experiencing heavenly states of being, and that doesn't exclude the fact that there are drawbacks. There is that the painful side of human existence. That's just, you know, in terms of the body. Then the mind, which, you know, we all want to be nice. And, you know, where do these thoughts and moods come from? Well, but we can be aware of them. We can recognize them. And we don't have to believe them or be prey to them. and in the just the world around us, it's fraught with difficulty, problematic nature. And that doesn't mean it's, say, looking at the drawbacks doesn't mean that one is pushing it away. It's just recognizing that by looking, well, and of course it ties in with the next quality. In terms, the next quality is nekamma, which is renunciation. And nekamma is one of the barami, in the sense of extremely wholesome qualities that are foundational to liberation. They provide a strength of heart that allows almost a literal translation of the word are qualities that allow the heart to cross over, like this. Just the word barami is where there's a movement implied, and so that in order for the heart to cross over from samsara to nibbana, to cross over from dukkha to peace, to cross over from defilement to these exclusively wholesome, one relies on certain qualities. And those baramis in there, and there's 10 of them, but the nekamma is one of them. And it's one that, say, in the English language, renunciation it doesn't get good press. And even in the Buddha's time, there's a really interesting discourse where a lay person is talking to Ananda and saying, and so basically the same kind of perception or problem in the Buddha's time as even now. He's saying, he's speaking as a lay person, delight in sensuality and pleasure this whole idea of renunciation is just really, I said that, well, that's the word, it's like a sheer drop off. Like, kind of the ultimate bummer. And the heart doesn't grow confident with it, doesn't rise up to it. And how is it that, there's these monks, and these young monks who are taking on renunciation, and so Nanda sort of said, "Well, let's go and see the Buddha." And the Buddha sort of talks and sort of said, "When I was still unawakened, still beginning my practice, I didn't get excited about renunciation either. It's quite normal in the human mind. But he said, but as one starts to investigate it and seeing that as one through this, say, renunciation, relinquishment, pulling back or putting down, releasing, that the mind became more peaceful and more bright." And then he goes into a whole, beginning with just physical seclusion and stepping back from a lot of engagement, it just feels really good. And I'm sure that say many people on the retreat, although there's just getting to the retreat, wow, okay, I can settle, okay. And that's a renunciation. It's just that renunciation, relinquishment, stepping back from a lot of engagement. So in the same, and there's this, we start stepping back from more and more, it becomes a bit more refined, where where we're putting aside the not just physically, but then also mentally, different aspects of simplicity, and the effect that has. It's that simplicity, then putting down different distractions that they're compelling, and it isn't as if they're bad or it's evil in some way, but it's sort of like, oh, just by relinquishing renunciation, the mind starts to settle more, and the mind becomes brighter. Then the Buddha goes on and sort of says, and then I'm practicing and my mind's becoming more peaceful, but then there's an obstacle. Realizing, well, I need to renounce, I need to relinquish vitakka vichara, initial and sustained thought, in order for the mind to become more peaceful, become more settled, so that directed thought, evaluation, just being able to unify, rather than having to figure it out, having to analyze it, just absorbing, just unifying, and then the mind becomes, and that continues, that the whole path starts to, you start realizing it's not a path of attainment, it's a path of relinquishing, and again, renunciation as a word. It does kind of strike fear in our hearts, but as we start to really pay attention to, well, what's it actually? Once we get over the conceptual, what's it actually feel like? So, oh, wow! It just feels good. It really feels satisfying. So that renunciation, I think, particularly as we go through this period of retreat, 10 days, and to reflect on this gradual path, but also some of these areas of renunciation. You think, that's only what the monks do, sort of thing. But it's all of us that are interested in experiencing the fruits of peace, there's an element of relinquishment and renunciation that is essential. There's a beautiful story. Well, I think it is anyway. But the Udana of He's a Sakyan who was, say, a ruler of the Sakyan clan. He went off and gave up his kingship, took ordination under the Buddha, after his ordination he's out in the forest, and he's just sort of, what bliss, what bliss. And the other monks sort of notice this and sort of, I think he's lost the plot here, and he's dissatisfied, and he's thinking about all this, all the good things that he used to have. They reported it to the Buddha, so then the Buddha takes the opportunity to question him and say, "Well, what is it that you're referring to when you people are hearing you saying, well, you're sort of exclaiming, what bliss?" And he said, it's not about anything from the past. It's if anything, it's when I think of the past, of how entangled and how fearful and how burdened I was, and now being able to live practicing Dhamma and having no other support for the mind other than Dhamma, it's incredibly blissful. So that I can't not say anything. So it's really that sense of when we really do put things down, when we are able to relinquish, then we do experience bliss, and it doesn't preclude actually doing anything. Really, it's more around attitude, because that just even the Buddha as an example. I mean, he had many. I think that I mentioned that. I can't remember. Just recently, giving it as an example, the Buddha being able. Of course, he had many duties, many responsibilities, teaching, leading, community, engaging in. But when it was time to do that, he did it. When it was time to put it down, he put it down. And there was somebody there, they were saying, you know, oh, you know, the bliss of happiness that, say, somebody like King Bimbisara, the king of Magadha, experiences, and that's must be far more superior because of the worldly avenues of gratification than the Buddha. And the Buddha just sort of says, well, do you think King Bimbisara could experience unremitting bliss for 7 days and seven nights? And he said, well, I don't think so. He said, well, I can. So it's just in seeing clearly, and I think, of course, that seeing clearly is it's always coming back to the Four Noble Truths, you know, in the sense of, you know, the Buddha puts it at the, say, at the end of this exposition, a gradual instruction. But the Four Noble Truths, you know, as we investigate them, practice them, seeing, you know, seeing dukkha, suffering, dissatisfaction, stress, its cause, cessation, path leading to cessation. But again, we're saying it's not a linear path. Our generosity, our giving, our virtue, our keeping of moral precepts, the view around what is, say, heavenly, what is a drawback, how to accomplish, those are all informed by our understanding of Four Noble Truths, understanding dukkha, understanding cessation of dukkha. And you realize that strengthens. It isn't that we have to sort of build this all up and then finally get to the Four Noble Truths, but we keep bringing those Four Noble Truths, reflecting where do I experience dukkha? Where do I experience stress? How do I experience discontent? What's seeding that? What's the cause there? Why is that coming into being? And how does it come to cessation? How do I experience cessation? What do I do to bring it to a place of cessation? So it's those that taking those Four Noble Truths, using them, and this is something that Ajahn Chah was just everything would come back to the. To the Four Noble Truths, and not in a formulaic way, but in an experiential way. Remember, there was a monk who was close to Ajahn Chah, and he disrobed, came back to America, and then when Ajahn Chah came to visit America, that layperson came and former monk came to spend time, traveled with him, helped him out, and followed Ajahn Chah through this whole trip. And he'd been practicing in different places and being exposed to different ideas, mostly in the Bay Area. And then he had a whole lot of questions for Ajahn Chah. And so one of them being, one is that, say that the path is all about mindfulness, being aware, and being fully aware. When we're completely and fully aware and mindful, then we will fulfill the path. And which is, and say in the idiom that Ajahn Chah would sometimes use, that's true, but it's not right. Or it's right, but it's not true. Sort of, okay, it's a part of the picture. And then the layman saying, well, I've got this close friend of mine who's been, he doesn't like formal meditation very much. And he said, but he feels, his path is rock climbing. So when he's rock climbing, then he's completely mindful and he's really present. And Ajahn Chah says this. I said, only Westerners would think they could get an enlightenment at rock climbing. You think he's contemplating the Four Noble Truths while he's rock climbing? Mm-hmm. And which is sort of that aspect, is it? Yeah, I mean, it's part of qualities, but it's how do we contemplate, investigate, bring those Four Noble Truths in so that they're informing all of the things that we're doing, and that's where we start integrating all these different qualities: generosity, virtue, heaven, the drawbacks, the dangers, renunciation, and the whole path of the Four Noble Truths. I'll offer that for reflection this afternoon, and we can.
And Mayana Vargataya Sadhu Parangadamasi Sadhu.